closer to about 100, 120 watts per square meter. I just looked up, 100 watt panel is about 58 by 23, which is roughly around 1,500 square meters. That'll put you right about 1 square meter of surface area. And another 200 watt panel advertises about a 13% efficiency. So I don't quite think you're going to get up to 200, and you're definitely not going to get up to 400 watts for a square meter.
So which cells are you using?
Welcome to...
Yeah, but 400 watts would be like 35% efficiency overall if you're in Phoenix, Arizona. I just don't think we can get those kind of efficiencies at the dollars that Joe is willing to spend. Yeah, you take the space-qualified, triple-layer-type, extremely high-efficiency photocells, the ones that have got one layer that absorbs the ultraviolet, one layer that absorbs the visible, and one layer that absorbs the infrared, and it combines them all. I mean, these are very expensive cells. Yeah, with those, you're going to get 35 to 40% efficiency, but you're going to spend a zillion dollars per square meter. But for the ones that he can buy, either Bob or John, for the price that Joe is willing to pay, what do you believe is the real efficiency percentage he's likely to get? Bob first. Go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, I'm inclined to think it's between 10 and 12% at the most.
That's what I thought. Let's see what John thinks. You got it, John.
Yeah, my understanding was that solar cell efficiency was also around 12% KD2BD.
And let's see what Glenn says. Glenn, what do you think is the percentage he's likely to get at the price he's willing to pay? KD2QIQ, K2LAW?
Well, let's see. I've got four panels on my roof right now. They're just strictly for charging batteries. That I use actually on the radio that I'm talking to you right now, and the output of each one of those arrays is a 70 volt array, and it does give me 250 watts. And the dimension of each one of the arrays is basically roughly two and a half feet by 4.5 feet, almost 5 feet. And during peak daytime hours, I can get as much as 250 watts out of it in this area. But as I said, you know, how much sunlight you can get different in Arizona, I'm not really sure. But, what I'm giving you is a real number. It's not, you know, something I'm guessing at. KC2QIQ.
Yeah, 2.5 feet by 4.5 feet is very close to 1 square meter, just a skosh over a square meter. You're getting 250 watts versus 1,200 per square meter. Okay, got that number in there correctly. Divide. That's 21%. Do you believe you're getting 21% solar efficiency, Glenn? Gee, that sounds awfully good. Without any lensing device put in front of it? KT2QIQ, K2LAW. What brand? Where did you buy them?
These are General Electric, and the ones that I have right now were basically prototypes that were given to me, and that were used for another project. And when the project was completed and it was finished, I kind of had them for my own personal use. So I kind of set them up to charge batteries with some inverters and everything else. But I've at high noon, you know, and I've got them positioned pretty well off the house, you know, and set them up into the sun with little brackets so I could, you know, catch the sunlight as best as possible. And the peak day, the peak output is about 250. I mean, on average, you're right. You know, it's not going to be 250 like all day long. I mean, you know, even during your full sunlight hours, you know, sometimes they'll go down to like maybe about 100 watts, 80 watts, and then the cutoff is real fast. I mean, you know, when the sunlight, any kind of shading happens, it just drops right off.
You said a mouthful. You said they were being used for a project. And when the project left over, this was a material left over from that project. Was that project a NASA project, a space project? Is there some possibility that those particular cells are the exotic ones, the extremely high efficiency, multi-layer ones used for space? And you weren't told, but they really are a hell of a lot better, like 2-to-1 better than what we can buy ordinarily as mortals. Is that possible, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LAW?
Well, Well, these weren't for space program. Actually, these were for a location where energy wasn't going to be available. And what it was for was actually for the project was a street lighting project where basically there was no room in the streets to put in panels. Since that time, I might add to this, that I don't even believe General Electric got the contract. As a matter of fact, from what I understand now, the company that that has taken over the panels and the lights together has been Philips and Siemens. They've been doing the most amazing stuff. So if you're interested in kind of solar stuff out there, standalone things, are they available? Yeah, you can buy it. And it's not, you know, unobtainium anymore. I mean, this is interesting word, made it up. Although it's made up before me, I can't even take credit for that. But no, they're around, Dick. I mean, you can get a hold of this stuff. And also another very cost-effective one is look up Samsung if you can find some of their stuff out there. This stuff is coming out of China now in Korea, and really, really inexpensive. It's coming down to amazing prices. I wouldn't even want to give you a price because I'm sure somebody would probably find it cheaper somewhere else. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Oh, by the way, the first time I heard the word, I was in California, and I was in front of, I'm having trouble remembering the guy's name. He talked to me about unobtainium. He also talked about rare ammonium. Rare ammonium and unobtainium, these were exotic little devices that you would find at a TRW flea market that came out of some kind of a space program. But you would fall in love with them, but there was just no more of them available unless you really knew somebody. That was the unobtainium and the rare ammonium. So Philips, Siemens, and Samsung. Now, because the people with high motivation for pumping electric power are the Germans right now, they've got this beautiful system where for every kilowatt hour you pump back into their grid from your solar cells that you have control over, whether they be on your roof of your house, in your backyard, or whatever, they're paying you, I think the number was 20 cents a kilowatt hour. And so that gives them high motivation to find high efficiency cells. In fact, some of the people in Germany are buying the land or renting the land alongside of the Autobahn highway, putting solar cells on it, sending the power back into the grid, collecting the money, and buying bigger and bigger wheelbarrows so they can take all that money to the bank. And that's what the Germans are doing. And as such, the whatever brand name of solar cells they're using, I think we want to get on board. So whoever knows what brand name Germany is buying for solar cells, solar voltaics, we want to know about it. Let us know. Let me give a little bit of a delay in case somebody can tell us that right now. K2RIW on the deck, man.
KC2QIQ.
Glenn recognized. Anyone else?
AC2AZ.
Okay, Glenn and Bob in that order. Glenn first, you got it.
Sure. One of the largest suppliers of solar cells that I know of today, you can forget Germany. I mean, they might be talking about doing stuff like we're doing here in the States a little bit more, you know, in terms of houses and things, but where it's really exploding is in street and industrial lighting. Throughout areas of Asia, this is China, and in where they're building cities left and right, they're not digging up the streets to put electric power lines down for street lighting. So what they're doing is all these solar cells are being used for a tremendous amount of street lighting. And the funny part about it is, I hate to give you a name. As a matter of fact, I would say it's better off just Googling, solar cells on, you know, and just see what you come up with from day to day. And it's going to change all the time because in Asia right now, there are sources that you can probably buy here in the United States to get a hold of these cells. And I really shouldn't call them cells. They're like panels and arrays you can get a hold of. You can also buy the inverters. Get the inverter along with it because this way it has all the built-in regulations so you can have your nice 115 volt or 240 volt output. Things are fantastic. And they're coming from all over the place, and the prices are coming down dramatically. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I sure wish our government would realize the value of solar voltaics, properly subsidize it, because the raw materials that go into solar voltaics are essentially silicon, sand. The raw materials are relatively inexpensive. The fabrication process to make a high-efficiency solar cell, that's elaborate. And so if we pour enough research into it, I'd like to believe we will discover ways of making them much more cheaply and higher in performance. Bob, AC2AZ, KQRW, you got it, Bob.
KC2AZ. Yeah, I looked up 201 GE while we were talking over here, and it's about 1.45 square meters. So that's still, for 200 watt, that's still putting you somewhere around 130 watts, 135 watts per square meter. But I think LIPA does the same thing with buying back the solar. I think we're doing it about 12 cents per kilowatt hour, but the catch is... they will only pay you that rate up to what you would normally use for the energy for the house. Once you exceed the typical energy for your size house, the rate goes down to about 3 cents per kilowatt hour. So, you know, on a good day, I think they assess this on a monthly basis. For the summertime, I think it would be very difficult to try and make back extra money to pay for those solar panels. But some of the manufacturers, again, looking on the website here, of Mitsubishi Electric, Hyrcera, Sanyo, Sharp, and then there's Canica, which I think is Asian. But then there's some BP Solar, Evergreen, GE, AAE Solar, Sunwise, SunTech, and Unisor. And this is only on one website, so there's a bunch of them out there. So.
Somebody slowed down that identifier. I think I heard Eric mentioning that earlier. That's going to have to be reset. The lots of brand names, and it still sounds like the number of watts that Glenn is getting out of his are above average. Somebody was giving him some supercells there, I think. He's getting a few too many watts per square meter, it appears. We'll soon find out. I believe he's really getting it. We've got to find out what brand name it is. You're going to have to look at the back of that panel and find out what brand it is, Glenn, and see if you can buy more of them at some kind of a reasonable price. And the super ones that they're using in the space program, that's just a matter of manufacturing. In other words, solving the process by which they manufacture, which right now is an expensive process, but with proper refinement, I guarantee there's ways of making that cheaper. So, when it comes to energy independence, I'd certainly like to see Mr. Obama push wind, solar voltaic, tide, the North American gyre. In other words, the Gulf Stream has a tremendous amount of energy in it. One of the things that's hard to believe is that when the sun shines on the Earth and it creates temperature differences in various places, the temperature differences create wind and create things like the Gulf Stream. Water moves and air moves. Both of them moving represents stored energy or kinetic energy or potential energy, call it what you like. Put the right kind of propellers in the right places underwater, put the right kind of propellers at the right places in the air, and there's a lot of energy to be collected there. Put the right kind of solar voltaics to collect the sunlight. So collect sunlight, collect wind, collect water motion, and eventually we become a hell of a lot more energy independent. And we don't buy 21 million barrels of oil per day that we import and give tremendous amounts of money to people who don't like us. And they do things with that money that we don't like. There's got to be a better way. I think I've gone down the list of people who signed in with questions, but I could be in error. Or somebody's come out of the woodwork with a brand new question. If so, give us your call letters right now. K2RIW on the TechNet.
2Z Echo Alpha.
WS2N.
3HYY.
Okay, I heard 2Z Echo Alpha. Somebody spoke a little too fast and the prefix got wiped out. I heard Joe and I heard Paul, in that order. 2Z Echo Alpha, give us your full call and your name and then proceed with what you would like to say. KQLAW, my name is Dick.
Dick, name is Glenn. Handle is November 2, Zulu Echo Alpha. And my question is about putting a stereo in a car. I have a head that's going in, and it's going to a second amplifier, and the head is telling me that I have an amplifier overload, and I'm assuming it's a mismatch between the head unit that puts out about 50 watts or so and the second amplifier in the trunk. My question is, how do you measure the input impedance to the input for the second amplifier, and should it be close to 8 ohms? Is that what the standard is?
Wow, that's a bit different. Okay, you've got, if I understood correctly, a couple of hundred watts out of something, and you've added another amplifier, and you're getting an indication of overload. Start off, once again, how many watts do you believe your source is? How many watts is the capability of the amplifier you're adding? And how do you know you're getting an indication of overload? Run that by, again, Glenn number two. You got it, Glenn.
Okay, thank you. Well, we bought a car stereo. It has a CD player in it, plays MP3s. The output of that is supposed to be about 200 watts. It's got four channels, so it's 50 watts a channel. The car comes with an amplifier built into it, so the easiest way to install the thing is just put it in the dashboard and let it run through the secondary amplifier. However, the thing we bought is tripping out. It says it's got an amp overload and the protection circuit's coming on. So I'm assuming that the input to the second amplifier is not proper. Now, I'm wondering, can I check that with an ohm meter? Will that actually give me an accurate reading, and should that be close to 8 ohms?
Yeah, I'm skeptical that you can measure that with an ohm meter. If I took, for instance, a loudspeaker that's rated 8 ohms under normal audio conditions, and maybe it's measured with a 1 kilohertz sine wave, and yes, that loudspeaker, when it's moving with a 1 kilohertz sine wave, presents an 8 ohm impedance. You put your ohm meter across that coil of that loudspeaker, and you might measure 2 ohms. There's a very big difference between DC resistance and dynamic resistance at the rated frequency of operation. So the amplifier might fall into that category. So what's in the car or what you're adding, I'm not sure which, 200 watts total. You said 50 watts per channel. Sounds like it's got four channels to it. And the secondary amplifier, you didn't tell me how many watts it's got. When it comes to driving an amplifier, I'd like to believe the level of audio required to do that, the usual auxiliary output from, say, for instance, a tuner in the old days, when you had a separate component-type hi-fi system, you had a couple of volts across a 600-ohm source as the source of signal that went into an amplifier that then gave you X number of watts into an 8-ohm speaker. Looks to me like you really ought to find out a little bit more about what is the rated voltage and level, impedance level, that's supposed to be used. Because even if this amplifier was supposed to be fed from a 600 ohm source, and it's supposed to be fed, let me pick a number, 2 volts RMS, in order for it to produce full power output, and you're feeding it from not a 600 ohm source, an 8 ohm source, that's intended to drive a loudspeaker, and you've eliminated the loudspeaker, and you put in an amplifier instead. And in that worst-case scenario I just described to you, a source that's intended to be loaded to 8 ohms is looking into something that's giving it a load of 600 ohms. Many audio circuits are rated for 600 ohms. That used to be the military standard that I worked with on intercom systems for aircraft. And as such, there's a huge impedance mismatch there, which could create distortion problems and other crazy things. So I think even though you may think it's okay, you can put an attenuator, a load
repeater. Time out.
You can put it in an attenuator and you can grunge the system and make it work. I would be more enthusiastic, as I see it, Glenn, to find the data sheet. Once you know a model number of a piece of equipment, and by hook or by crook, by asking the right guys on the right website or the right ham radio operators, hey, a model number XYZ amplifier, who's got a data sheet for it, even though it's a discontinued product? By one way or another, you're going to get a data sheet. I would start off there in order to make sure this is all coming out right. I'm going to send it back to you, Glenn. Drag your feet a little bit in case somebody with a lot more audio knowledge than I've got comes along is going to give us a better answer than that. N2 ZEA with a little delay. K2RIW in the TechNet.
2AZ, I have some input.
Go ahead, Bob.
Glenn, what I heard there is you're taking one amplifier and putting it to the input of another amplifier. That doesn't sound too healthy. You're taking something that I think you said was a 200-watt in-dash unit, and then you're putting it into the amplifier that's already in the car. If you're taking that 8-ohm output of a 200-watt amplifier and putting it into the audio input of the car amplifier, you are lucky you didn't blow everything up. I think that's what you said. I'm not sure. Could you come back to that again?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. There was an option for getting a special cable that was supposed to match the two units together. I didn't do that. I got a pinout sheet that showed me what the what the wires were for going in. I did that, and the amp is tripping out. It's 22 watts a channel, and I know it's a possible thing to do because the kids do it all the time. I'm just not having luck.
Two, QIQ.
Greg, Glenn, number one.
I think I've seen this kind of problem happen in the past, where you use an attenuator type of cable out of one amplifier to go into another one. And usually what happens is the output of the amplifier that you're trying to connect to the input of the other amplifier is what's called a bridged amplifier. In other words, either side of those speaker outputs cannot touch ground. And what's probably happening is one of the sides of the amplifier driving the other amplifier is actually touching ground potential or chassis potential of the car, and that has to be lifted nicely. KQ2QIQ.
We heard you okay, Glenn, but you were very noisy. Whatever change you've made made your signal 30% noise and 70% audio. And he didn't buy that recommended cable that you're worried about having an undesired ground to it. He just made a direct connection. And just like, Bob was saying, I think it's not a recommended procedure. Even though kids have done it and maybe they think it works, let's do it right. I recommend you get the real data sheet and find out what are the real impedances. And your amplifier, even though it's got 20-some-odd watts per channel, might have auxiliary audio outputs that are intended to go into another amplifier as opposed to using the real output. And if you don't have those auxiliary outputs and inputs on the amplifiers in question and pieces of equipment in question, then to make the right kind of a dummy load plus attenuator so that the source of the signal is seeing the right impedance and the new sink of the signal is seeing the right level and impedance, making a resistive load plus attenuator assembly is a relatively easy thing to do once you know the specifications of the equipment involved. That's not rocket science. I didn't say it's super simple, but it's not rocket science. I know that an enthusiastic radio amateur who signs into the TechNet usually is capable of handling a thing like that. So I'd go back and get that data before proceeding is, I think, the best approach as opposed to just trying things and possibly creating some further damage. N2ZEA for any other comments, K2RIW in the TechNet.
So do you think it's possible that if I just put an 8-ohm load across the output of the primary amplifier, that might bring things down in perspective? And where do you get a resistor that can handle 22 watts at 8 ohms?
They sell L-pads just for that purpose. So that's a commercial product. Again, you want the data sheet to find out. Yes, what you described is the beginning of the process of doing it right. And they sell commercial products to do exactly that once you know the specifications involved. I would recommend you go and find the specifications, Glenn. By the way, when you do, dig into this a little bit deeper. Find the specifications. Choose the right power L-pad that Eric just told us about. He, being in the broadcast industry, knows exactly where to buy a thing like that. What's your guess, Eric, as to what he would have to pay for this power L-pad that you just described? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Guys, just let me get this right. He's trying to make a volume control on a speaker line, right?
Not quite. He is taking the 22 watts output per channel, 200 watts total, he said, of a amplifier A, I think is installed in the car. He's going into amplifier B, which has some power output he didn't tell us, and he's getting an overload indication. The second amplifier is tripping out. Sounds to me like he's overdriving it. So
data sheets on everything involved is the right approach, but the answer might be, you called it a power volume control. I would call it a power level setting control, because he has another volume control on the second amplifier that's really going to be driving the final loudspeakers. So that power attenuator, which doesn't have to be variable, it can be a fixed device, I think.
Is he going into the input of another set of amplifiers?
Roger, Dodger.
All right. Generally, what we do, it's like when we do a broadcast feed for many different services, there's a couple ways we do it. We used to do it with 70-volt lines, but we don't do that anymore. We generally feed an 8-ohm parallel pair down the table and terminate it into 8 ohms, and then usually take like 10K pots, and everybody can take what they want, because the input impedance of most of the stuff, non-broadcast, is about 10K, broadcast is 600 ohms, but you can actually bring it to high impedance of 10K, so that's one way to do it without distortion going from a lower impedance to a higher impedance, but you still need the thing properly terminated. So, I mean, why is an amplifier's output feeding another amplifier? That I don't get.
There's something else.
Well, the amplifier came with the car, and the car was set up to have the dash unit run that second amplifier, so we swapped out the new dash unit, and that's the thing that's tripping out the new dash unit. So it's the first amp that's tripping.
Okay, is this extra amplifier for a subwoofer?
No, left, right.
So, you're feeding this second amplifier with 8 ohms. This is not a replacement for what was originally there, is that correct?
Yeah, because the second amplifier is buried in the trunk somewhere. I really don't want to dig it out of there. Yeah, but I just don't know what to feed it with or how to measure it.
Okay, because usually if it's been installed by the manufacturer, the second amplifier to drive the big speakers in the back, usually they feed line level to it, so it's 10K. If you're taking speaker lines from, say, the first amplifier, you're going to have to do a little level changing here, because the second amplifier's inputs are, you know, they're high impedance and low level.
KW2HWW with a comment, please.
I heard Glenn and Howard in that order. Glenn, go ahead first.
Yeah, this is something I've done plenty of times, restoring old Corvettes, and you want to upgrade. You want to keep the original radio and restore the original radio inside the car, which has got speaker outputs, but you still want to drive a audio amplifier in the back. And a device that you can get in most of the audio stores, if you go to like Cartoons or any one of those places, it's called an adjustable line output converter. And basically it wires to the left-right output of one, you know, the plus-minus of the left and the plus-minus of the right output. And it basically gives you two RCA jacks on the output and a little pot control so you can adjust the level so the radio volume control will line up with the new amplifier. KC2 QIQ.
What's the approximate price of that thing, Glenn?
I'm holding one here in my hand, and unfortunately I can't find the price on it. But I think it was somewhere around $25, Dick.
Beautiful. So it's not huge. Howard, what would you like to add to all this?
One, that's a very inefficient way. He should bypass it. When you start taking your amplifier and turning down the volume control of the first amplifier to try to get its output not to drive the other amplifier, you go into class AB distortion. You're going to have crossover distortion. Number two, you're going to dissipate a lot of power there. You have to load that amplifier down. That amplifier, the output of the amplifier, has got to see 8 ohms or close to 8 ohms. And what you're trying to do is sample some of that signal. That's a very inefficient way to get the audio. And doing it that way, you are going to get some distortion. Over to you, Dick.
Yeah, if he was trying to adjust the level by using the volume control of the first amplifier, which is intended to drive, let me pick a number, an 8-ohm loudspeaker, but it's really driving either a 600-ohm or a 10,000-ohm input line level audio input of the second amplifier, not only is there a huge improper loading and huge impedance mismatch, down the level low enough on the first one, your signal-to-noise ratio is going to degrade and crossover distortion and so on. I think there's an intermediate setting here. It is my belief that not running the full 200-watt power output capability of the first guy in his four channels, cutting him back to something more like the 1-watt level, where he's still got a very good signal-to-noise ratio, and dissipating only a couple of watts in that power attenuator that properly drives the second line input of the second amplifier, I think there's a compromise solution here. And hopefully the second amplifier has some kind of a volume control, but even if it doesn't have a volume control, and you have to use the first one, there is a compromise level setting, I think, that'll make this all work. Now, a guy who's worked with a lot of audio and broadcast would be Eric, and see if my guess is at least in the ballpark. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
All right, K2RIW, KE2EJ. From what I'm hearing, I don't know if I'm hearing it right, the first amplifier is driving a set of speakers, so that makes it terminated. But the level's going to be way, way too high to just go into another amplifier, so... you could just take a 10K pod or buy the device that Glenn was talking about. I've seen them. I actually have a professional version of that, which is active, and actually has a set of amplifiers that couples a high impedance line into a low impedance line, a little driver amplifier, and some knobs on it, and gives you a set of phonos out.
And so
I guess the real problem, if I understand correctly, Glenn number two, the amplifier that's installed in the trunk, you don't know its model number, and getting the data sheet on it is going to be real difficult. Is that sort of what you're saying, Glenn?
Yeah, exactly. That's why I didn't really want to dig it out of there. But it's the first amplifier, the one we just put in, that's the one that's tripping out. It probably doesn't like the impedance of the second amp.
Two Alpha Sierra Sierra.
Alpha Sierra Sierra, recognized. We'll get to you in a second. The amplifier that's installed in the trunk, was it done by the car manufacturer? In which case, there must be a owner's manual or service manual that'll tell you something about that. Or was that an aftermarket addition? Glenn number two, go ahead. ZEA.
That came with the car, and the original head unit was a basic radio, and that fed to that amplifier, so I figured it would be a simple thing just to swap out the head units, but more is involved.
Okay, since it was done by the car manufacturer, there's got to be a way of getting data on that amplifier. Alpha Sierra Sierra, go ahead with your information. Start off with your name, sir. My name is Dick.
Hi, my name is Greg, and to Alpha Sierra Sierra. It sounds like what the guy is, he's trying to make a push-pull amplifier situation is what it sounds like to me. And it sounds like he's talking about audio. I just heard real quick, when I was younger, I had a similar problem. I wasn't overdriving the second amplifier or anything, and the first amplifier kept going into an overload condition. And what it turned out to be was a tremendous mismatch on the impedance of the first amplifier to the second amplifier. The first amplifier is looking for 8 ohms or something around there. 8 ohms, possibly 4 ohms, most likely 8. And you have that, you're driving another amplifier. That's why it's overloading, because of, it thinks it's a short circuit condition and it's overloading. You have to get that impedance match system that the other person was talking about. And that was all I had to say. That's my feeling on it. I could be totally wrong, but that's my feeling. Back to you guys, and I'll be out for a little while.
Oh, I think you're onto something here, Greg. Although you said a short circuit, and I mean an open circuit. I am guessing the line input of his second amplifier, the one downrange, is something like 600 ohms or 10,000 ohms. The first amplifier is looking for a 8-ohm load, and it's seeing 600 or 10,000. It thinks it's looking into an open circuit. It thinks the loudspeaker has become disconnected, and it's giving an error indication accordingly. It calls it overload, and yes, it's a voltage overload, if it happens to be a particular style of amplifier. So it's beginning to look like try to get as much data as you can from the automobile manufacturer. Measuring the input impedance of an amplifier is a little bit tricky. I don't know if you can do that with an ohm, you know. Let's see if...
It depends. Some amplifiers are capacitively coupled at the input, so you don't read anything. Are you saying that the first radio or the first amplifier is not connected to any speakers?
Exactly. It goes right into the second amplifier.
Okay. Is this the radio that it's coming out of that's going to the second amplifier?
Yeah, it's a basic head deck. It's like a Clarion, plays CDs, MP3s, all that.
Right. Is this the radio that came with the car?
Negative. We just bought it. We're replacing the one that came with the car.
Okay. Now, you're using the wires that was from the original radio to the amplifier in the back, correct?
Yes, that's what I'm trying to do, but I'm not 100% sure. I got the pinout for some data sheet on the internet. It does sound like it's right because you can go from left to right and front to rear. So I'm assuming it's correct.
Okay, we're not talking about how it's wired. Who's the manufacturer of the car?
Alexis.
Okay. You can go to the dealer and tell them to get you the schematic for the original radio. And I'm willing to bet you that the radio that connects to the amplifier in the back did not put out 8 ohms speaker level. It puts out probably 10K IHF level, which is about a little less than 1 volt, around 1 volt when you got the volume all turned up. So you went out and bought another radio that's intended to be connected to another set of speakers. You might also take a look at that radio and see if there's low-level output for driving an amplifier.
By the way, 1 volt into 600 ohms is a milliwatt. Quite possibly the amplifier that's being driven is looking for a milliwatt of signal, and you've only got 22 watts driving into it. We're only wrong here by 22,000 to 1 in power. I think you get a little bit of an idea of what we're talking about here, Glenn number 2, ZEA, RIW.
Okay, so I guess my best bet is to go to an audio shop and explain the situation and see if they have a matching network pre-made then.
Will you be 2HWW?
First of all, I think that question was directed to Eric, and then we'll go to Howard in that order. Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, well, one thing that I will say is that any of the devices that you buy in the audio shops, okay, bridging devices, they're intended that the amplifier be connected to a set of speakers. Most of these amplifier outputs will give you nothing but pure distortion if they're open, okay? It's got to have a load on it in order for it to function properly and make nice, clean audio. It also has to function properly if there's protection circuits in there that's dealing with it. It knows when it's open. It also knows when it's shorted. So, given that, your easiest solution, if you don't come up with a solution, you don't find out that there's actually low-level outputs on the radio that you just bought, is put a set of speakers in it, and then take yourself a nice 10K pod on the plus side of each one, hook that 10K pod across the speaker line, take the wiper to 10K pot and feed it to the second amplifier and turn the knob where it's an appropriate level. But you've got to have that first amplifier properly terminated in order to get decent audio out of it. Back to Dick, and then you can give it to Howie.
Yep, I agree with all of that. An unloaded amplifier that's made for 8 ohms looking into 10,000 or 600 is going to be unhappy, with rare exception. The only exception I can think of is that if you had an
it's got transformer output, no problem.
If it's got an extreme amount of negative feedback, so it really is a kind of an operational amplifier, a constant voltage device, an extremely high so-called damping factor from the audio world.
Yeah, they usually A, B, push-pull.
Understand. Okay. Howard, what would you like to add to all this? You got it, Howie.
Maybe the radio has a low-level output so he can hook up an iPod, not an iPod, but he could hook up something else like another device. Number two, Dick, if you want to measure the impedance to an input of an amplifier, the proper way to do it is to have a signal generator at 1 kHz, and then you take a pot and put that in series and go to the input, and then you put your scope at the point, and you look for half the voltage, and once you get to half the voltage, then you measure the resistance. That's how you do it. You look to you look for the voltage drop across that resistor, across that variable resistor, and that should be half the voltage. And once you get half the voltage, then you measure the resistance, and you know what the input impedance is to the amplifier, then. K2RIW, WD2HWW.
KC2QAQ.
Glenn recognized. Yeah, the guys at Pratt were all told the half-voltage technique, and I think it was K2BUS, Arthur Seidman, who gave us that one. Let me run that one by again, because it may help Glenn if he's not able to get the data and he wants to make the measurement. I'm assuming he can get a source of a 1 kilohertz signal. And by the way, an audio oscillator circuit, if you look that up on a website, a very simple circuit with a running off a 1.5-volt pen light cell will give you a nice sine wave, 1 KC audio. And when you start off with a known voltage of audio, put it through a series resistor into the unknown load, and when the unknown load has the exact same voltage drop as the series resistor, so you get half the voltage across each, then by definition, both are the same impedance. And if a series resistor of 600 ohms did that, and it gave you half the voltage across your input of your amplifier, when there's a 600 ohm resistor in series between that amplifier input and your audio oscillator output, then you know you've got 600 ohms, and that's one way of confirming it. Let's see, Glenn's got a comment on all this. KC2QIQ, go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, this is just, you know, such a common thing that I've you know, come across from time to time, different guys in the radio, the car clubs, you know, we're basically restoring cars and trying to match old radios with newer amplifiers, or go the other way around, where you have amplifiers still inside the car and you're replacing the heads. It's a very, very common kind of a problem, and usually the solution that most of us take in the end is we wind up going to a store like Cartoons, because they have little kits and adapters where it pretty much names all the different types of cars that are out there, and as long as the radio is something relatively new, you know, that you just purchased recently, and you're trying to get it to line up to the car wiring, usually, you know, the two problems you run into is just as been mentioned, is, you know, the output impedance of the amplifier, you know, you're trying to drive speakers, and it's, in the meantime, it's being wired to an amplifier. That's problem one. Problem two is, generally, speaker outputs in car systems are not grounded. In other words, both sides of the speaker are floating, because the amplifier is a bridge type of amplifier. And you need these kind of kits and little isolator circuits, because they keep both sides of the circuit off of ground. Because when you have your RCA connector and that plugs into another amplifier, one side inevitably could be ground, and that's another very unhappy situation. So there again, if you run into too much trouble, go to one of these local car shops, and you know they usually have these kits on the wall for all makes and models. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
And most of the amplifiers are complementary symmetry output, or they're running in Class C, and you got to be careful.
Yeah, I think both of you guys have hit on something here. There's a so-called H-bridge kind of amplifier setup, where it is capable of giving you twice normal voltage, but both leads of the speaker must be floating from ground to do that. In other words, I could be running an amplifier from a 12-volt battery. I can be producing 12 volts peak-to-peak on the left-hand lead of the loudspeaker and 12 volts peak-to-peak on the right-hand lead of the loudspeaker. Therefore, I can allow the loudspeaker to see 24 volts peak-to-peak if I've got it properly floating with one of those kinds of an amplifier. And since the input circuit of the amplifier in the truck probably has one lead grounded, and you're trying to feed it from the output of the new radio, and it wants both leads to be ungrounded, that's possibly one of the reasons it's giving an overload condition. And again, the right kind of an adapter network is going to solve it. Quite possibly, Glenn number two, you've got a known radio and a known high-end automobile, and if you go to the right shop, they'll say, yes, that's combination 3 with combination 47. We know about that one. You plug in circuit number JA, and the problem goes away. That's one other possible solution. N2ZEA for any other final comments. K2RIW on TechNet. And by the way, Glenn, when you do get a solution to this, We'd like to hear about it. Although it's a little off to one side, it's audio. Ham radio operators are curious about a lot of things. We'd like you to come back and tell us what worked and what didn't work. N2ZEA, K2LIW.
Excellent. You guys gave me some great ideas. I think I'm going to dive into this. I think we'll get it done. Appreciate your time. Thank you very much. And then we'll get back to you. N2Z Echo Alpha.
QB2HWW with one more very important safety comment.
Yeah, go ahead, Howie.
Remember, some of these new amplifiers are running Class G or whatever they're running, and they're not capacitively coupled to these speakers. Some, you know, the old typical is a complementary symmetry amplifier with the 2 meters, and you went out to the capacitor. Today, they're using like a bridge, or they set it up in such a way where the 2 amplifiers are sitting on either side of the coil of the speaker. They do that for frequency response. You know, everybody wants to get down to DC or close to DC, so they don't run a couple. So you have to be very careful. You can blow one of those output devices. And remember, they're running those things now in digital mode, where they now recombine and go through some kind of phase shift to get the AC back, because they can get 80 to 90% efficiency out of these audio amplifiers, and they don't have a heck of a lot of heat taking dicks.
Makes sense. You got to be careful. Paul, I know you wanted to make some comments. WS2N, what's going on in all of the above? K2LIW in the second half.
Oh, okay. No, just a quick change of topic, Dick. I was looking through QRZ for some of the call letters after our field day. And, now you look through some of the bold-faced titles there, and the QRZ post. I saw something about Morse code. And I said, well, you know, what's this about? You know, it's something to do with bringing it back. Well, you click on it, and they talk about this new device that the public will probably be using. So Shiba and Intel are involved with this. Nowadays everybody wants to text, went from cell phones to just texting on. Became such a big thing. And now they have something, there's something called Twitter. Well, this is called Click. Click like is CLIQUE, like a click. Let me drop it. And what they said is that there's going to be a gadget that they're going to come out with where you'll be able to send text messages. It'll have 3 buttons. It'll be just like a little device, a little wider than a pen, and 3 buttons on the top. The left button will be a dot, the right button will be a dash. The middle button, if you click it once, that'll separate the letters. You'll have a W, da-da-da, and then you'll hit the middle button, for the next letter or number. And then if you want to separate words, you'll take the middle button and just click it twice. And so they said the only thing is that anybody who wants to learn this is going to have to learn Morse code. The reason they want to come out with this, let me drop it, is because you don't have to look at your little keyboard or cell phone or whatever you're sending. You don't have to look at letters. You could send, you could just send there. You could hold this thing in your pocket, and you could be clicking out, sending a message to somebody using Morse code. What's old is new again. It's something, this bold-faced title is, it got me interested in reading. So if anybody hears about this, I haven't actually seen this thing, or know when it's going to be coming out. Apparently it's out in Japan already. And they make comments that hams will be maybe hired to teach people how to use this thing. And then you read the comments from other hams, and they make the comments, with electronic keys, you don't need a button in the middle, you can push the one on the left, or it'll make a regular dot for you, just like an iambic key or whatever. But already the comments are coming out. I thought I'd mention it, Dick, if anybody hears about it or sees it, finds out what they're selling for, or whatever. I'd like to hear about it eventually. Back to you, Dick. WS2M.
Very interesting. There was a guy who I used to work with named Dick Peacock, Whiskey 2 Golf Foxtrot Foxtrot, who has since retired to Alabama. They used to live on Long Island, and he was a Morse code operator from way back, and a DXer. And he worked for the field engineering department, so they sent him in his station wagon automobile all over the United States. So while he was driving along, he would attach a Morse code key to his leg. His right hand was tapping out Morse code while he was driving. Did that for years and years. Never had any accidents. So a skilled CW operator can listen to Morse code, transmit Morse code while driving an automobile, and never take his eyes off the road. I don't know whether or not he had a left-hand foot switch that operated the transmit-to-receive function, or if that was maybe something that was attached to the Morse code key. I think it was attached to the Morse code key. He would press a lever that, or it was a push, you know, a single push to transmit and another single push to go back to the receive mode. But I'm pretty sure he never had to take his eyes off the road. So this click thing sounds like it's getting close to that. I presume what you do with this click thing is by pressing the left-hand button making dots, the right-hand button making dashes, and the space button in between, I am guessing you record a message and then the machine sends it all in one burst. Is that approximately what happens? Because you wouldn't need a space button if you were transmitting live. A skilled Morse code operator can transmit dots and dashes with just the right timing between letters and words, and he's doing that. But it sounds to me like this is some kind of a recording device, and it's going to send it all in one burst. Is that approximately what happens, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, that's what would happen. You know, like you're sending any kind of text, it's going to go off one packet. And they did say you can't receive on it. So, you know, you'll have to check your regular email or your cell phone to receive on. But just a transmitting device. So you want to send a message to somebody, and you're at a business meeting, and you're bored, and you put your hand in your pocket and start transmitting away, I guess. It's more or less the way they described it. So I was kind of fascinated with the story. Didn't say how many dollars it would cost or anything, but how many what the output is or anything. But very, very interesting little topic. I guess probably one or two batteries. I guess you maybe two AA batteries. I guess you would put in this. Just vision, you know, trying to vision what it looks like. Again, if anybody sees anything like this in the future, it'd be good to hear about it. I would like to see it. You know, I mean, one guy made a comment saying, "Look, Morse code has just been done away with for amateur radio, and here it is coming back again." It's very ironic.
Now, many of us have seen that bake-off competition that took place on the Jay Leno show between two Morse code ham radio operators and two skilled guys who are using text messaging. The text messaging was significantly slower than the Morse code operating. I'll admit that a person who is using a real QWERTY keyboard, touch type enthusiast, who can type 120 words a minute, he's going to beat everybody when it comes to getting a written message out. But none of us have a handheld device that's got a QWERTY keyboard to it, and you certainly are not going to be using that when you're driving down the road. And people are trying to send text messages while driving, a rather dangerous procedure. I can see how you don't have to find the right key. See, with the crazy layout you've got of the keyboard that you're using on a handheld device for sending a text message, finding the right key and pressing it at the right time in the right order to spell out the words, that's a bit of a problem. You don't have to find the key when you're sending dots and dashes. You know exactly where it is. The dot is under your thumb and the dash is under your index or vice versa finger. And so as long as you know Morse code, I can see how that is going to be a faster way of sending a text message. For we ham radio operators well, most code operators, it's a great way to go. The general public, there's only one ham operator per 500 in the general public. The general public does not know Morse code. So I think that represents a little bit of a problem. I can see why this would be a device advertised on QRZ.com. You're not going to see it advertised on eBay or Amazon.com. That's an opinion. Anybody got any further questions or comments? Give me a call. It's K2LIW on the TechNet.
And one more comment, Dick, WSY.
Call recognized. Anyone else? Go ahead, Paul.
You mentioned the truck drive. I've spoken to probably about three or four people over the years driving in that car or a truck with the keys attached to their legs or somehow rigged up in the vehicle. And I used to be amazed to find out the guy's flying down Route 80 and talking to me in CW. But as far as that went, you know, as far as transmitting, they really don't have a problem. You know, when I transmit CW, you know, I just start transmitting away, and the radio starts transmitting. Then when you're on key, you're receiving, so it's no problem there. He didn't need another button for transmit or anything like that, Dick. Just to let you know how they were doing that. And I thought of that Jay Leno show too. And although they did say they made sure they found somebody in California that was real good at CW before they went on that show. And I heard about it too late, and they said, oh, it's on the net. By the time I got onto the net, it was already taken down. It was probably a month or two later. So I never got a chance to see that. They did make a comment in this article, something along the lines where you could, in some cases, send the CW faster than the text. The only thing I don't like, I think it would be kind of weird. You know, I'm listening to my radio, you know, as I'm going along. If I make a mistake, I could hear it. And this thing in my pocket, not be able to, you know, if it's coming out in an audible tone, it would defeat its purpose. You know, I'd like to hear, you know, the dots and dashes as I'm pushing the button. I think that would be kind of hard to get used to, pushing the button without listening to it. Back to you.
Well, the buttons could have tactile feedback, but I like your idea of a Morse code operator. I mean, what do they call it now? A code practice oscillator, where you actually hear the tones as you press it, and that way you're getting confirmation. And yes, the equivalent of full break-in, in other words, when you start pressing the key, the transmitter automatically goes on. You don't have to have a transmit-receive switch. That's one very nice thing. There's another comment I was going to make. The Jay Leno demonstration, maybe it was on a particular website that's taken down. I'm relatively sure, Paul, it is on YouTube. So if you use the right search words on YouTube, you're going to find that Jay Leno competition between text messaging and Morse code operating. I'll bet you it's still on YouTube. Okay. Field Day happened this weekend, and I intended to visit a whole lot of Field Day sites. A couple of funny things happened in my house that kept me delayed. I didn't get a chance to go out until quite late on Saturday night, so I managed to go to Limox Field Day site in Wantagh, I think it is, and got into some very nice conversations. Didn't get a chance to visit the other site that I intended to visit. The Limox setup, they've been doing it for quite a number of years, and they've got it very nicely set up with two different ladders acting as guide towers with a total of six sets of guys on each ladder with, I think there were 20-meter beams on the top of those, and the whole system is fed with a nicely wired 5,500-watt pair of 5,500-watt generators where the 110/240-volt wiring runs along the fence in a very safe manner and then makes the shortest possible run across the field so that very few people are tripping on it. They're using guy rods in the ground, which I think are really rebar rods that are, I'm going to guess they must be 6 or 8 feet long. I tried moving the stakes in the ground that are holding the guy wires, and you could not move them. Very safe technique. I visited a number of Field Day sites where there are temporary guys, rope guy wires, holding up the tower, and some tiny little spike in the ground, a couple of inches, is what's holding it all up. And if the tower falls over, it's going to fall on a tent and damage equipment and people. I've seen very poor guying techniques, and I was very pleased to see welder repeat.